Welcome you to this special event in the Haven Center's fall series. The last time Guy Standing was here was for a conference as part of the Real Utopias project, a conference on basic income and other devices for a kind of a new order of redistribution. And he just asked me the question, did I remember who the person who was at that meeting who has become super, super famous since then? I scratched my head and I couldn't remember. He reminded me that Ed Miliband came to our meeting last time. So potentially the next Prime Minister of Britain got his formative intellectual engagements in the Real Utopias mode at Wisconsin.
Exactly.
I know his father's father. I think it's probably the case that his father, Ralph Miliband, known to many of you, had a slightly bigger impact on his intellectual work. So, Guy Standing has been long known as a central and important progressive figure at the ILO, working on questions of inequality, economic security, and related matters. But recently, I guess in the last 6 years, has been away from the ILO, first at Monash University and now at the University of Bath. His PhD is in economics from Cambridge. We don't hold that against people. We're very broad-minded in our views about credentials in this pluralistic environment. And so even economists occasionally do have decisive and incisive things to say about the fate of the world rather than just obfuscation about the current state of affairs. So, today we will hear about the precariat and how Guy Standing proposes to understand it.
Okay, thanks very much, Eric. I hope everybody can hear me. It's very strange that it took me about 30 years to conceptualize and write this book called Work After Globalization. And I found that it resonated with a lot of people, and I was invited around the world, and I gave over 50 presentations. And there was one subject on which the activists and the students around the world, whether it be Japan, Korea, Brazil, Italy, Germany, or the United States, where the interest really focused. So I decided to take that theme and try and write it as a narrative that was accessible not just to labor economists and labor specialists, but to a wider audience. So that's the origins of this book. And I've been invited to a large number of presentations already, and it's only just come out, and it's the subject quite clearly. And it reminds me of an aphorism of Heraclitus, who said, one never steps into the same river twice. So when you're presenting a book, you're never quite sure which version of the book will come out. So I don't even know myself what I'm going to be saying, and I hope you will be able to follow the theme. Now, the book asks and attempts to answer five questions. What is the precariat? Why care about it? Why is it growing? Who is going into the precariat? And where is it taking us? Now, before I go into the five questions, and I'm going to be very schematic, as you understand, for the time reasons, and hoping that I will say enough to entice some of you to want to read the book, I want to give two stories, two anecdotes. A few years ago, a gang of youths dressed in cartoon character costumes waltzed into a Hamburg gourmet supermarket and proceeded to take the biggest trolleys they could find and put champagne, caviar, smoked salmon, every item that they could identify in the carriages, and proceeded to take pictures of themselves as they did so. And then they waltzed up to the checkout lady and handed her a rose and a note and promptly walked out, not paying it for anything. She rushed to the owner, who called the police, and the police mobilized 14 police cars to chase this gang, and they obviously were very conspicuous in their funny costumes. And they also mobilized a helicopter, a police helicopter, to fly all over Hamburg to look for this gang. Well, I'm delighted to tell you, they were never caught. even though they proceeded to hand out the food around in the back streets of Hamburg. And the note that they'd left said, "We are the precarious workers of Hamburg. We produce the wealth of Hamburg, but we don't have any of it." Now that gang, not surprisingly, has come to become part of the folklore of the European precariat movement, which has been growing, and are called the Robin Hood Gang, you know, for obvious reasons. And they are primitive rebels, the sort of primitive rebels that historically have always come in great periods of transformation. Primitive rebels are people who know what they're against, but they do not know yet what they are for. And it's a very specific stage. The second story is an underbelly part of the growth of the precariat. In Prato, which is near where I live, for generations it was an Italian city with garments and famous for its family firms, with labor coming from the south of Italy. And it never had anybody else except Italians. A city of 180,000, and then suddenly, in 1989, a group of 36 Chinese migrants came via Frankfurt and came to Prato and set up a sweatshop. And in the next 15 years, the Chinese migrant sweatshop population of Prato grew to such an extent that they accounted for 40% of the workforce of Prato. And then, of course, the crash came. And whereas the Chinese had been tolerated because they brought in revenue and they'd contributed, they'd not made any demands on the state and so on, and traditionally Prato had always been a city of the left, always, year after year, had voted for the left. When the crash arrived, almost overnight, the neo-fascist Northern League wiped the left out, took over, and Berlusconi, freshly re-elected, lovely man, he said, "My first objective is to defeat the army of evil," by which, of course, he meant the undocumented migrants, starting with the Chinese in places like Prato and the Africans in Calabria and other places. And the Chinese ambassador rushed up to Prato when they launched these vigilante attacks at night and said it reminded him of the 1930s. Those are two stories which give some flavor of the precariat development. Now, what is it? The first question. Well, there are two ways of thinking of the growth of the precariat. One is to think of Weberian ideal types. It's a group that you can identify as a group. And the other is to think of a process of precariatization that's taking place that affects large segments of the population. In the next few minutes, I'm going to concentrate on the first type of presentation. But in the book, in both books, I've tried to develop the whole process of precariatization rather more fully. Now, the great thing about globalization, and this is something that we observed a lot working in the ILO, as working in developing countries a lot, is that you've got a global class structure that's been taking shape. It may be a little crude, but essentially the class structure has an elite of these abysmally affluent billionaires and multi-billionaires in their criminality at the top, striding the globe. Underneath that you have a salariat with long-term employment security and all the employment trappings of pensions and health insurance and paid holidays and all the rest of it. And alongside that, a growing number of what I call proficients. The proficients are, you know, a combination of professionals and technicians who are people who don't have employment security. They're project-oriented. They have bundles of skills. They don't want long-term employment. They are happy in their independence and their trajectories of being brighter than everybody else. Their only danger is hubris and burnout at the age of 31 and a half. But the proficients are a growing number. Underneath the proficients, you have the dying working class. André Gorz's death of is probably premature, but it was shrinking and has been shrinking for the last three decades or more, globally. And it's below that that you have this new emerging group of the precariat. And I'll come to that in a minute. And below that, below the precariat, are the unemployed, the long-term unemployed, and the lumpen precariat, an underclass. And I think it's very important analytically and politically to differentiate the precariat from an underclass. There's been a lot of mixing of the two. An underclass is a drag on the accumulation process, whereas the precariat was something that was wanted by global capitalism and is functional to global capitalism. Now, if we try and define the precariat, a point I'm making in the book is that it is a class in the making, not yet a Marxian class for itself, in the sense that there are various insecurities and characteristics of the precariat, but there isn't a common vision of what to do to overcome the precarious existence. And a concept that I found quite useful, that we don't use very much, perhaps you use it a lot in Madison, but I don't see it used around the world, is the concept of a denizen. A denizen is an old Roman concept, and it was a medieval concept in Britain. It refers to someone who has a more limited range of rights than a citizen. So cultural, political, social, economic, the limited rights. And more people in societies are actually becoming denizens. But the first characteristic that everybody thinks about when they think about a precariat is that they are insecure in terms of their jobs. They're in and out of jobs, they're in and out of the labor market, they don't have any sense of secure employment, nor do they have a sense of secure income, secure benefits, and all the labor rights that were built up in the 20th century. Those labor rights or labor entitlements, they don't receive. But more importantly, I think, conceptually, is that people in the precariat do not have an occupational identity or an occupational narrative which they can give to themselves. They cannot define themselves for various reasons as being something and on the route to being something. And this is a real absence which is very strongly felt. And in the sense, there more and more people do not have what Hannah Arendt called a social memory on which to call. In other words, a feeling that they belong to a community with ethics and values and traditions and standards which they inherit and reproduce themselves and are expected to reproduce. This lack of a social memory goes with the sense that they need to be opportunistic. Because the other side of the coin is that the competitive individualistic labor market means that in most cases there's no shadow of the future hanging over their deliberations and exchanges with other people. I meet you today, you meet me today, we'll never meet again. So you can take advantage of me, I can take advantage of you, because we've got no sense of reciprocity or solidarity that you and I expect to need each other later. So this lack of social memory and lack of a shadow of the future produces a sort of very opportunistic, chronically insecure existence. And the final point that I want to make, because it's analytically important, is that there are varieties of precariat. Some people entering the precariat from working class communities, working class families, relatively little education, and they're going into it with certain values, certain fears, and are easily misled by the sirens of populism, and I'll come back to that. In the middle group, the second group, are the people who treat jobs more instrumentally, the migrants who keep their heads down. They don't expect to build a career, but it's relatively good compared with where they're coming from. So they tend to become politically detached, unlike the first group. And the third group consists of young, educated, relatively well-informed people who are suffering from considerable status frustration. And this is the third group, which I'm going to come back to later. Now, the second question is why care about the precariat that's growing in our midst? Well, first of all, obviously, anybody who's in a very precarious set of circumstances is going to be vulnerable to extreme marginalization. They're going to be vulnerable to have one more accident than they've been able to take into account and go in to become bag ladies or the equivalent of men. This sense of being vulnerable to going into an underclass. But there are four A's that tend to be characteristic of the precariat subjectively. The first is suffering from a sense of anxiety, chronic anxiety. Globalization has produced economies in which the essential main part is uncertainty. Donald Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns, which cannot be insured against. In the old welfare state era, if you had certain contingency risks, at least you could work it out actuarially, what social insurance you needed to be able to work out probabilities, and you could have benefits. But with our globalized market system, people are suffering essentially from insecurity due to uncertainty, exposure to shocks, and difficulty of recovering from them. The second A is they suffer from Durkheimian anomie, in the sense that there is a despair of escape. We all know that the channels of social mobility have been reduced, and the probability of upward mobility is much lower now than it used to be. This is something that is globally reproduced, even though in the United States it seems to have been a bigger drop compared with many other countries. And this anomie goes together with the development of what I call a precariatized mind. The precariatized mind arises from the fact that if you are living a precarious existence, you cannot afford to concentrate all your efforts on one sort of activity. You have to take account of networking with different groups. You have to spend time learning new skills just in case yours become obsolescent. You have to fill out resumes all the time. You have to constantly flit your attention. And of course, that goes very quickly into an attention deficit syndrome. And if there's anybody here who has a recipe for avoiding the development of the precariatized mind, I would, for one, like to know what the recipe is, because you should patent it. Because I think this tendency is affecting many of us. The third A is a sense of alienation. Because increasingly, a large proportion of the population are forced to do what they would not like to do, and cannot do what they would like to do. A classic recipe for alienation. And they feel underemployed because they're educated or whatever, well above what they're forced to have to do, and they feel overemployed because of all the pressures on their time that in fact makes them feel stressed and suffering from the various forms of insecurity. And the fourth A, of course, is anger. Because they see the celebrities, they see the winners, they see the elite, the famous 1%, and this induces a stress, an intolerance. And in the book, which was written and published just before the riots in England, a number of journalists called me up afterwards and said, "How did you manage to predict what has been happening?" Because I talk about the likelihood of days of rage and the Euro-Mayday movement becoming much more pervasive. And of course, this year we've seen this with the various movements in Tahrir Square, in Syntagma Square in Athens, in Madrid, where I've been speaking, and various other places, and now, of course, the Occupy movement, which is the next phase of that process. But of course, the precariat has not yet found a sense of agency. They've not found collective voice, but it's rapidly developing, and we'll come back to that at the end. The next question is, why has it been growing? Well, I don't think it's sensible to look for a smoking gun and having, you know, a single explanation. And having said that, I'm going to focus on a gun and mention a couple of other factors, but I genuinely believe it's a combination of circumstances. When globalization took off and the neoliberalism came into vogue, the essence of neoliberalism was competitiveness. Everybody has to be more competitive with everybody else. It's not the old Adam Smith model of exchange economy. It is a competitiveness-driven model. And commodification of everything, plus a systematic attack on collective agency. Milton Friedman wrote his first book, 1945, where he was actually laid out that that was essential for a market economy. You must dismantle collective agencies. And Hayek had the same perspective. It cannot be seen as a period of deregulation, the globalization era. It was a period of labor market re-regulation. I'll come back to that if I have time later. But the essence of globalization was that the liberalization of market economies almost overnight, historically, resulted in the trebling of the world's labor supply. A trebling of the world labor supply where nearly 2 billion extra workers entered the global market system. And those extra workers were all prepared by historic history to labor for a 30th or a 40th or even a 50th of the wages and benefits of US, Europe, and so on. And the Faustian bargain that governments made was the following. In liberalization, the benefits to capital, to finance capital, were going to be huge. But there were two things that were going to happen. Either wages and benefits would drop like a stone in the United States and Europe, or a lot of those good jobs would be transferred to Chindia and elsewhere. Neither of those were politically sustainable. And of course, the Faustian bargain essentially was, while wages fall slightly, and while jobs and division of labor change slowly, we will top up declining wages with tax credits and labor subsidies and cheap consumer credit. An orgy of consumption, you pay later. Now, of course, the earned income tax credit in the United States became the biggest welfare scheme in the world, and other countries, including my own, introduced their own variants of tax credits. Now, that, of course, could not go on forever. A Faustian bargain always comes to a point where it collapses, and it collapsed in 2007, 2008. And I think it is a mistake analytically to blame the bankers and the... I was going to say something else, but the bankers for the crash. Because essentially, it was a system that was established in that period. And the essence of the message was labor market flexibility. I saw this from the inside in the ILO. When I first wrote about it in the early 1980s, the senior directors of the ILO said, Guy, you're wasting your time. The subject will become passé in a couple of years. And it's still the number one subject. The Greeks are being told to make their labor market more flexible today. The Italians are, the Portuguese are, and so on. And what a flexibility means is three things. One is numerical flexibility. Numerical flexibility means removing employment security, increasing use of casual labor, temporaries, part-timers, all the rest that we know, outsourcing and all those things, phony independent contractors and stuff that we've seen being analyzed. That erosion of employment security was a global phenomenon. But besides numerical flexibility, wage system flexibility is something that still we haven't fully got to grips with. Essentially, wage system flexibility meant not just allowing wages, money and real wages, to decline, but it meant stripping the social income away from lower earners in the labor market. So systematically, you had an erosion of all those enterprise benefits that had been built up in the laborist period, that had been going to workers and that unions had fought for, and so on. Whereas the salariat were gaining more and more of those things, longer paid holidays, more subsidized this, more subsidized that. And so though we observe a growth in money wage inequality, because wage differentials were growing because of various reasons we all understand, the actual growth of social income inequality was much greater, because those elements that were being taken away from the emerging precariat and were being given in spades to the salariat were worth a phenomenal part of the total remuneration. Now, in addition to that, you had a reform of the welfare system across the world. And the reform essentially moved away from any idea of Beveridge and Bismarckian social insurance and so on, towards means testing and targeting of benefits on the poor. The poor. Became a huge concept that too many people use without thinking about the implications. So if you target on the poor, you then say, well, maybe you chose to be poor. You at the back there chose to be poor because you're a lazy bummer. Therefore, we have to make a distinction between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. And if we do that, of course, we have to introduce not just means tests, but behavior tests. Are those slippers under your bed your slippers, or some man who's helping you with your income? Are you really looking for a job, etc.? And the tests multiply. Now, if you have a means-tested system, you automatically introduce poverty traps. Poverty traps whereby the precariat, if they're moving from the welfare system benefits into those low-wage jobs that don't have any benefits anymore, they are effectively paying an 80% tax rate. In some countries, it's risen to over 100%. In other words, they earn less by going into a low-paid job than they would get on the benefits. Now, even if you taper it with tax credits, you still find they're facing marginal tax rates over their realistic income stream of double what your middle class is paying. Your middle class may be paying 30%, they're paying 80%. Now, they don't raise tax rates on the middle class and the elite because they say it would act as a disincentive for them working. But the poor, of course, can face double that and are expected to go out and take low-wage jobs. Well, there's a certain irony in that. But what has been happening is that if you introduce all those behavior tests, you introduce a new phenomenon, which I call in the books the precarity trap. Now, the precarity trap works like this. If you lose a low-paying job, you have to start making claims to get some sort of benefit. You are probably less educated than most of us in this room. You are mentally fragile. You've been beaten down. You don't know how to operate in the system. So you apply and you join a queue. You've got the wrong form, sir. Go back. Come back tomorrow. You've got the wrong thing. You answered the wrong question. And it turns out that millions of people are facing a queuing process where they don't actually get any benefits for 2 or 3 months, and during which time their savings are exhausted, they've used up their friends, and they've run up debts. Now, I mentioned this last night to this Occupy group in Maine, and a man in the middle stood up and he said, "You're talking about me." Now, imagine then what happens. Suddenly, a nice, friendly labor exchange, probably privatized, making a profit out of you, and therefore every person they place in a low-paying job, they get more income themselves, says, "The other side of Madison, I found you a possible temporary job paying subsistence wage, no benefits, but you should go for it." Now think about it. You're facing an 80% marginal tax rate, your poverty trap, and there you're going, and then you face the possibility that within 3 weeks you're going to go all the way back and start again applying. This time, having to prove that you didn't voluntarily leave your job. Now, millions of people are put in a precarity poverty trap at the bottom of the labor market, and it contributes to this anger that is out there. The third form of flexibility is functional flexibility. And I think it's absolutely important, and too many economists do not make this distinction. The distinction between employment security and job security. Employment security is when you have an employment contract. A job security is when you have a niche that you feel you control, and you're developing it, and you're going places. To give you an example, France Telecom, which is one of the biggest employers in Europe, extraordinarily strong employment security for the vast majority of its workforce. They suddenly found that a whole lot of workers were committing suicide. They had long-term employment contracts, they had good wages and so on, and they couldn't understand why these workers were committing suicide. So they did an investigation, and they found that the reason was they'd introduced a job flexibility scheme where every 3 or 4 months people were shifted from one part of the place to another and having to learn new bundles of tricks. And the stress of having to adapt was actually terrifying for a large number of people. And I think it's important that job insecurity is something that has been increased enormously in this period. And in this book, I analyzed the whole process of occupational dismantling that has taken place in the globalization era. If you think about it, one statistic will give you a picture. In 1980, 1 in 20 American workers was subject to license for doing their work. They needed a license of some sort. Today, it's more than 1 in every 3. And that's the same in other countries. More and more people must have a certificate, must have qualifications, and therefore be either restricted from practicing their occupation or not. And I could give some ridiculous examples of where this applies in this country. But more importantly for my story here is that the regulation has been transferred from inside occupations, the old occupational guilds, the professions and crafts, to occupational boards with a mandate to run competitive, consumer-oriented regulations. And what has happened, and I won't go into how it's happened, is that they've splintered many forms of occupations. So there are an elite who are allowed to have occupational mobility alongside a group of para, semi-qualified people who do not have the prospect of going up inside an occupation. And just to give one example there, in my own country, copying American laws, as increasingly they do, they got the big ones in 2007, the medical professions and the bar. And they introduced a Legal Services Act. And it's promptly being called the Tesco Act. But Tesco is a big chain of supermarkets in Britain. And the reason it's called the Tesco Act is that very soon, and it's already started because it came into effect last month as it happens, you will be able to go into a supermarket, and if you want a divorce, you'll be able to go up to a man or a woman with a nice white tunic on, and there'll be legal services assistant. And you'll be able to go up and say, I want a divorce. And they'll direct you over there, and you'll be told to press the key buttons. If you want a no contest divorce, you press one lot of buttons, etc., etc., and within 2 weeks, you'll get your standardized divorce. If you want a will, you'll be able to do the same thing. And, of course, it's going to result in a huge number of paralegal people who will never become lawyers. So you're creating a precariatized mass of people. Now, the next aspect is very close to home. And I hope I do not cause offense, because I'm sure Madison is the only university that bucks the trend that I'm about to mention, which is educational commodification. In the period of globalization and the neoliberalism, we have seen a systematic transformation of the education system around the world. So we are expected to produce two commodities, degrees and graduates. And if we don't produce them efficiently enough, then we get into all sorts of trouble. We have to process the product and produce people with certificates. I'll give one example. A professor at a university that's quite well known had the audacity to fail 2 of his students. He was called in by his dean and said, look, you can't fail students. You can have deferred success, but you can't fail them. Why not? They weren't doing any work. Well, if we fail students, it will get out there and will put off other potential students from applying to come to this university. You can't fail them. He said, I'm sorry, but they didn't do any work. They were useless. I'm sorry. He said, go away and think about it over the weekend. Came back on the Monday, called in by the dean, and he said, and? No, I'm sorry, but they're still failed. Well, I think the Vice Chancellor would like to see you. You can probably guess the end of the story. He was sacked. He took the university to court. This is a true story. He took the university to court. He won damages, but he never got his job back. Now, the commodification of education and the stripping of the subversive cultural side of tertiary education is a scandal of our age. It really is a scandal of the age. We are expected to produce people with job tickets. It's putting it a bit bluntly, but essentially what is going on. And in that process, we are producing people who are buying a lottery ticket. And increasingly, millions of students around the world know they've bought a lottery ticket and a false prospectus, and they come out and they know there are a few winners of the lottery prize, but they're holding a ticket that's worth less and less. And that is producing this incredible growth of status frustration that is taking place. The final factor, which I really hope somebody is going to run with and write a fantastic PhD. And that is, we have a tertiarized society, and we haven't yet got an idea of tertiarized time. In industrial capitalism, time was in blocks. You got up in the morning, you went to the factory, you went home, bed. You went to school, if you were lucky, for a few years, worked for 30 years, a couple of years retirement, dead. It was blocks of time, if you were lucky. But in a tertiary society, we do not have blocks of time. People have to work all the time. They have to combine their labor with various forms of work. That 15% of every year you've got to spend in training, 20% of your time dealing with your financial affairs, 20% of your time dealing with the bureaucracies that are encroaching on your life, etc., etc. And we do not have a sense of control of time and the ability to be in control of time. And that is contributing to this precariatized mind. But also, if you think about it for about 32 seconds, you will quickly realize that the precariat has to do a lot more work for labor than any other group in society. A lot more work for state, because they've got to do all those things, those forms. A lot of work for reproduction, because they can't call on expertise, they cannot call on help for their family care and so on. And the inequality of time control is one of the terrible features of the growth of the precariat. I'll stop at that point for that question, and then very briefly go into the next one. Who is in the precariat? Well, I have two ways of answering this question. The first is to say, all of us, except possibly Eric, have a high probability of being in the precariat. It could happen at any time. None of us should feel smug, because any of us could have an accident, or fall foul, and drift into the precariat. That's one sort of answer. And particularly people who are thinking that their children will be part of the precariat if they are not themselves. But the other answer is to say that, of course, there are certain groups that have a much higher probability of being in the precariat than others. Youth, for reasons I've talked about. Anybody who wants to go to China will find that there's a phenomenon called the ant tribe, where millions and millions of educated youth are drifting around desperately trying to survive. It is not just a phenomenon in rich industrialized countries. Women obviously comprise a very large percentage of the precariat from various ways. Even though we've just been through what's euphemistically called the Great Man Session, we know that really that the women are being pushed more into these precariatized jobs that have been spreading. And we have this incredible phenomenon of the bag lady syndrome, where apparently millions of women in various countries wake up at night fearing that they're going to end up in the street living out of a couple of bags. The old ages are making up a growing part of the precariat, and I say in all of these groups you will find grinners and groaners. The grinners are the people who actually don't mind being part of the precariat for various reasons, like the student who's doing casual jobs, that's no problem. The old ages are doing casual jobs, but there are others who are the groaners who are desperately insecure, are hanging on. Besides them, there are the disabled. We have a very warped appreciation of the disabled these days. Increasingly, we seem to determine to push them back into low-level jobs, increase the stresses and strains placed on them, including all those suffering from episodic disabilities. And the Supreme Court ruling recently, which I read because I just found it so fascinating, whereby that someone who can do 3 hours of domestic work suddenly becomes capable of therefore taking a labour market job and therefore must be required to go into the labour market. That is a sort of gradually shrinking the boundary of disability. You also have welfare claimants and the incredible number of criminalised that our society, and not just here, the number of people who've been criminalised in France, for example, has tripled in the last 15 years. The same in the Netherlands, it's more than doubled in Britain. It's not just a United States experience. Once you've been criminalised, you're not likely to get out of the precariat existence, if you're lucky even there to be there. But in addition, of course, the biggest group, the final group, are the migrants. Now, the migrants are the victims of the precariat. They're also being used as a leverage in the growth of the precariat. They're the light infantry of global capitalism. We have more migrants now than at any time in history, but unlike the period 100 years ago, more and more of the total migrant population are circulants rather than settlers. And I just want to mention one particular phenomenon, which is that certain countries have become labour export regimes. China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, a number of others are organising the mass movement of hundreds of thousands of workers, including hundreds of thousands of convicts, to go on short-term projects on dam building, road building, various other activities on short-term contracts if they're lucky. Of course, as one Chinese manager that I quoted in the book says, they're relatively easy to manage. Well, if you're managing prisoners, no wonder. But don't think that it's only happening in developing countries. It's happening in the United States. It's happening in Europe. The Greek government, in order to get some help from the Chinese government with their bonds, agreed to allow the Chinese to bring in Chinese workers to work in their ports. The Polish government recently put out to tender their highway system, and it was won the tender by a Chinese state corporation bringing in Chinese workers, subsidized by the European Union. So I, as a British taxpayer, am subsidized so that the Chinese could come in and work on building the Polish roads. There are a lot of people in Britain who don't think that's particularly fair. I don't understand them, but there you are. Now, there was a poem seen on the door of one of these dormitories of this large mass of Chinese migrants. And they've been seen in many places that you wouldn't expect, including the Nirvana of social democracy, Sweden. And the poem on the door said, "We are all floating around in the world. We meet each other, but we never really get to know each other." And that seemed to me a classic precariat poem that was very, very poignant. Now that leads me to the last question. Now, I'm inclined to say I'll just do half of it and then hope that you will want to read the book to read the other half. But I think that's a bit unfair, so let me briefly go through both halves. The final two chapters are, where is the precariat taking us? The first one, the prospects of a politics of inferno. And the second one, with a due apology to Dante, of course, is a politics of paradise. Now, the politics of inferno goes something like this. We have societies of denizens. We have these yawning inequalities that are not addressed. The access to the key assets of a tertiary society are gradually whittled away. Time, the commons, public space, knowledge, all those things are denied to the precariat. And you have the growth of the panopticon state. The panopticon state is something that is growing everywhere. And the surveillance and the data surveillance and the profiling is so reminiscent of the panopticon that it's almost palpable that you get leading social thinkers who are using the language of Bentham and the panopticon in their policy books. And the language, of course, is the book Nudge. Everybody knows that book. I'm sure it's widely read and discussed. And if you read it and you look at it, it's one of those books that I advise people to read if they want to keep their bathwater hot in the evening. Because it should keep your blood pressure up and it'll keep the water warm. Now the essence of Nudge, it's libertarian paternalism. And it is saying you lot out there are suffering from an excess of information and you cannot make rational judgments. And therefore must be nudged to make the right choice. Now this is so utilitarian. And the utilitarian ethos is the dominant one, which is why they can demonize a minority. The greatest happiness of the good allows you to punish and take away benefits from the minority. Very consistent with the panopticon. But at the same time, this state paternalism, this libertarian paternalism, is gone to the point where when Barack Obama was elected, one of the first things he did was appoint as chief regulator in the United States, one of the co-authors of that book. And when David Cameron was elected prime minister in Britain, one of the first things he did was appoint the other co-author as advisor in Downing Street and setting up a behavioral insight team, which was quickly dubbed the Nudge Unit. And the deputy prime minister was sagacious enough to say that this unit is designed to make everybody make the right choice. Now think where that leads. Now we have a situation where we have the development of the panopticon state and the insecurities of the precariat, but the worst thing about the politics of Inferno is the drift to a neo-fascist populism. The neo-fascist populists play on the fears of that first variety of the precariat and a lot of people who are fearful of falling into the precariat. Berlusconi in Italy was a classic in the sense he knew where he should place his appeal to the electorate. He played on the fears of the domestic precariat against the migrants, that part of the precariat. And it's very interesting that we have the most vibrant precariat movement now in Italy. And I was in Milan and we had a wonderful election week, just the last election, where his candidate, and he comes from Milan, was beaten by the precariat candidate, which was a real harbinger and a lifted the spirit. But the neo-fascist populism is growing all over Europe. Your Tea Party, the fanatical right, we listen to your candidates on the Republican side and we cannot understand how anybody can take them seriously. But don't worry, we have our equivalents in Europe. And they're gaining in charisma. They're gaining in their buzzwords. Marine Le Pen has a good chance of doing very well in the French presidential election next year. And the far right is making huge strides in Sweden, in Finland, in Germany, in all over Europe. It is something that is really a crisis. And the only reason for being optimistic is that more and more people in the center, the political center, are becoming aware that they are losing out because their old social democratic message doesn't resonate with the precariat. It's not selling. They're losing votes everywhere. And at the same time, they see this drift to the far right. So suddenly, people like me are getting invited to their congresses to speak. And last week I was in Westminster talking with Labour leaders, whereas 5 years ago they probably wouldn't have given me the time of day. And next week I'm doing it in Belgium and the Netherlands. And that's because they are scared. The social democrat groups are scared. And that leads to the last point. which is the politics of paradise, is emerging in the squares. Gradually, this primitive rebel phase is giving way to a set of demands. And the set of demands are crystallizing around the great trinity of the Enlightenment. We want more equality. We want more freedom, including associational freedom that has been eroded in the globalization era. And we want more fraternity in communities that function and have a voice for the precariat inside them. And they aren't just subjects of policy. And that is turning, I think, to greater consideration of things that a few years ago would have been laughed at, including a basic income, a universal, unconditional, individual basic income. A growing number of people and a growing number of political parties are taking up the cudgels of this. They're also talking about capital funds for financing and shifting away from subsidies to be able to afford a basic income. And the greatest experiments that we've seen include what's happened in Brazil. When I first went and talked about basic income in Brazil in the mid-90s, we were given short shrift and we were laughed at. Then later on in the 90s, invited back, and certain mayors were bravely introducing a Bolsa Escolar for women with children, as long as they sent their children to school. When Lula was elected, he was a bit skeptical, had to be persuaded to go national with the Bolsa Família. Today, more than 50 million Brazilians receive a monthly cash transfer, in effect, a basic income. And when we had our Congress, our Bien Congress, last year in July in São Paulo, Lula took the time to spend an hour and a half talking with a small group of us about it. And he told me bluntly, he said, "I know I was only re-elected president because of this policy." But he was brave and he's done it, and now other Latin American countries are doing it. In India, where I'm going after this trip, we are doing a pilot where a whole lot of areas, we are doing a two-year pilot where everybody in the villages individually is getting a basic income cash transfer. And 5 years ago, the government would have somehow stopped us doing that. This time, we're getting from the Prime Minister's office, the Planning Commission, quiet support. Any help you need, do it. And you're seeing in Europe a growing awareness and willingness to discuss this. Now, there are other policies for improving security, improving control over time, improving the voice of the precariat in social agencies, in occupational agencies. And I hope that you will want to look at that in the book. But I want to end with one particular idea that I've put in the book, which is that we are suffering from a deliberative democracy deficit. We all see the commodification of politics. We all see the thinning of democracy. And we need to strengthen deliberative democracy. When I was last here with Eric, we spent 3 days, I think it was 3 days, talking about the various options. And I believe that it would be very valuable if, in introducing a basic income, and it may be called something quite different in order to be sold by the politicians, stabilization grants or whatever you want to call them, when we had stabilization sharing grants, that we attach a moral condition when people sign up to receive that stabilization grant, they make a moral commitment to not only vote in national elections, but to participate in a deliberative democracy day once a year and participate and listen to the various points of view on key policies in a town hall or a village hall or so on. And there are historical precedents. Read Tom Paine again, and you see how in the early stages of the United States, round the fireside, people deliberated. And de Tocqueville marveled at how that was part of the democracy in America. And, of course, there's a much earlier precedent. In ancient Athens in 403 BC, they had a system whereby all the citizens, a And there were many things wrong in that society, we know that. But all the citizens were given a basic grant, which was essentially a payment for them being publicly involved in the life of the polis. Now, it's a policy that I think could fly given the decline of democracy, but it would only be a moral condition attached to a basic income. I'll stop there, and thank you very much for listening, and hope you'll find it of interest. Thank you.